Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to start talking about some new research from the University of Pennsylvania on eating peanuts may lead to better arteries and healthier hearts. Also, how low-frequency electromagnetic field exposure is linked to motor neuron disease. Wow, that means all those Wi-Fi in classrooms, in our buildings, the type of communication systems we have in our cars. Yeah, every time you're in a car and you have those signals, those Bluetooths people use behind their ear, cell phones, computers, they're all giving low-level frequency electromagnetic field radiation. British Medical Journal is concerned about that. Infant vitamin B1 deficiency leads to poor motor function and balance, so that's easy to correct. Drinking tea may prevent diabetes. That's good, and a lot of people should. Omega-3 supplementation is associated with an increase in irisin and also lowers your C-reactive protein. From University Medical School, and a lot more on health and healing. I have a guest in the second part of our program, Professor James Gilligan. Professor Gilligan is a professor of clinical psychiatry at New York University's Medical School and also is a professor over at New York University Law School. He's a Harvard grad, and he's done a lot of original work on violence. And he's going to give some very unusual and interesting insights. So we're going to talk about why are some politicians more dangerous than others? Are shame culture, inequality, unemployment, all these are associated with violence. So we're going to take a look at these parts of the puzzle and see if they make sense. Also today, a commentary from John Whitehead, Rule by Thieves, 1 week in the American kleptocracy, and the new delinquent U.S. car loans at an eight-year peak. Now, why would anyone care? Well, when you look at student loans that have defaulted, credit cards that are late, and also mortgages that are late, and car loans that are late, and defaulting, no one's paying attention. Well, you should pay attention because you're dealing with 50 million Americans, and that represents a substantial amount of debt that is not going to be repaid back. They don't have the money to repay it back. So when people are talking about how great our economy is, which economy are you referring to? Because there's certainly great days ahead for some, terrible days for others. I'll explain. From our audio file today, and again, this is all based upon if we have time, we will look at the left is no longer liberal. Many people don't appreciate it. I want to show you why I'm very concerned. Now, I'm neither left nor right. I simply look at what is important and real, and that's what I will share with you. I don't look at the moniker associated with it. Also, Monsanto's weed killer found in alarming amounts in a lot of commonly consumed products, a fruit extract that kills cancer, and body organs of over 18,000 Syrian children have been sold. Who's selling all these kids' body organs? That's terrible. Also, massive protests in Yemen. You wouldn't know from the American media because they simply didn't cover it. Why not? We try to go around the world to show you the issues that impact everyone. And we certainly will do that today. I doubt that we'll have time for talkback. If we do, it'll be at the end of the program because I'm pretty sure this guest I'm going to have on is going to take a lot of time. I'm going to devote a lot of time to him. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. This is about eating peanuts. With a meal, that can help protect against cardiovascular disease, which in turn can lead to a heart attack or a stroke. Now, that's according to a new international team of researchers. In this study, overweight men, but otherwise healthy, who ate about 3 ounces of peanuts with a high-fat meal had a blunted increase in lipids in their bloodstream. And what that meant was it did not negatively impact their heart because they were already overweight. That meant that the peanuts had the ability to take stiff arteries, which are going to kill you, and soften them. And that resulting in the elasticity and the arteries being more pliable can allow you to live a longer life. And also, if you've got stiff arteries, it can limit the availability of nitric oxide. And when you have less nitric oxide, the arteries don't dilate that much. What you want is a dilation of the arteries so the blood can flow through, the arteries to be supple so they can move, and you want them really elastic. That's the key. Just remember, I've used this many times, but it's still a value. As an example, imagine a brand new water hose. It's pliable, it bends, it's fine. You sit it out in the sun, a year later it's stiff and doesn't move. That's your arteries. So over time, the arterial stiffness response can limit blood flow through the body, and that can cause the heart to work harder, and that increases the risk of serious cardiovascular problems over time. Quote from the study, as the heart works harder and harder over a long period of time, it could lead ultimately to heart failure. So according to the researchers who report their findings in the current issue of the Journal of Nutrition, eating peanuts can help the cells that line the arteries stay healthy, keeping them more elastic. So that is very important. Good. Eat organic peanuts. By the way, the best peanut in the world is the Brazilian peanut. It has a kind of a red-brownish skin to it. You can buy them already hulled and in a bag, and it'll say Brazilian red peanuts. That would be my number one selection. From the British Medical Journal, there was a study in the Netherlands. It was also published in Occupational and Environmental Medicine. And what it showed was that the workplace exposure to very low frequency electromagnetic fields, you can't see them, you can't feel them, you don't know they're there, but they're linked to a doubling in the risk of developing the most common form of motor neuron disease, ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And that's very serious. The association was evident among men who have been exposed through their work. Now, ALS is probably the single most difficult condition if you're a therapist to try to help with. I remember a really wonderful human being. He was my editor, Don Benson, and he was the editor-in-chief of a publishing company I was with for years and years, and it was in no small measure because Don was the editor-in-chief. We had an understanding about looking at what people needed and then doing books based on that. And little did I know, in fact, I did not know that he was world famous for writing Old West novels. And in fact, one day he was sitting in the Tri-State Healing Center, and two people went over to him and started talking to him. And he was signing stuff. And I said, what was that all about? And he said, oh, nothing, you know, just some fans. I said, I didn't know that editors-in-chief had fans. He said, oh, it's about the other things I do. He'd written like a dozen books. Anyhow, Don had ALS, and he kept it from everyone until it was very late, until it starts to, you can't keep your balance, you can't hold food down, start seeing double vision, have trouble thinking and focusing. It really is devastating. So we put him on a protocol, and a very vigorous protocol, and it substantially improved the quality of his life. And just a wonderful human being. In any case, I can tell you that working with multiple sclerosis Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, myasthenia gravis, and ALS. ALS is the most challenging. So the takeaway message is this. We've seen a lot of research that suggests that ALS might be linked to workplace exposure to extremely low-frequency electromagnetic fields, electric shocks, solvents, metals, and pesticides. But flaws in the study design and methods of these studies have undermined the strength of the associations found. They may or may not be causative. But the industries that promote these products will find any flaw and then have undue control in the press about what story gets out. So in a bid to try to avoid these pitfalls, the study authors relied upon data from the Netherlands cohort study, and this has been looking at diet and cancer and has involved more than 58,000 men and 62,000 women, and it's been going on since 1986, so it has lots of people over a long period of time. And they have very detailed histories of their diet, where they work, and their exposure to solvents, pesticides, metals like lead, mercury, and then electromagnetic frequencies. And lo and behold, they found that the electromagnetic frequency was a primary contributor. So what we have not known in our society is the cumulative effect, the cumulative exposure, the duration and intensity of low-level electromagnetic pulses. Look, everywhere you go where you take your cell phone, you're taking electromagnetic pulses with you. When you're driving in a car and you have a cell phone at the same time, you have two different sources just in that car. Because how do you think that car gets satellite radio? That satellite, every satellite, is beaming down a beam. And that beam that's carrying the signals, that's a pulse. And that pulse vibrates in there. Power lines. Ask any farmer why they don't want their dairy cows near electric power lines, because the death rate in the newborns is very high. Miscarriage is very high because of the pulse. If you live within a quarter mile of a power line, overhead power line, you run a risk. Then think of the television, the computers that are always on. So now you're at home. You got your television. Even if it's off, it's still not unplugged. So you're still getting the electromagnetic pulse. That's why when you hit a button, it immediately comes on. You've got your cell phone. You got your computer on. You got Wi-Fi somewhere going on. Well, it's a wonder that we haven't had a major epidemic before now, but it's accumulating. So just be aware of that. As much as possible, try when you're not using a cell phone, which you should only use with they do sell, and there's several companies that sell these earpieces that have a tube, and the tube changes the vibration so nothing gets into the ear. So that is a benefit. When you're not using your computer, turn it off. Reboot it, but when you turn it on, that saves you. And get a little meter. It's not expensive. You can go around your house and it'll tell you where you have these pulses and whether they're dangerous or not. And lo and behold, one of the most dangerous places people have in their home is either their desk or their bed, because they want the clock beside them, the digital clock, mistake. And they generally have some form of radio or computer in the room. So turn it off and stay healthier. From Tel Aviv University, published in Maternal and Child Nutrition, a study about infantile vitamin B1. Vitamin B1 is thiamine deficiency. It can severely affect the motor function of preschoolers who were fed a faulty formula in the first year of their lives. So you've got to make sure, if you are nursing, to take a good 50 milligram B-complex, because it's going to go through in your body, or 25 milligrams. And once your child is weaned, or if they're taking formula, make sure they're getting vitamin B1. It doesn't require a lot, 1 milligram for infants. But they looked at infant deaths and found that B1 was a contributing factor because it was deficient. Also, we know that drinking green tea is healthy. There's over 5,000 articles on green tea. Well, according to the latest Journal of Clinical Nutrition, the polyphenols, the natural plant compounds found in tea, significantly reduce the amount of glucose in adults. Wow. That could help with diabetes and prediabetes. So have a cup of green tea each day, sweeten it with stevia, and help maintain blood sugar. And finally, from University Medical School, omega-3 supplementation is associated with an increase in irisin, I-R-I-S-I-N, and the lowering of the C-reactive protein. This was a randomized double-blind trial published in the archives of Irenium Medicine, found an association among coronary artery disease patients between supplementing, giving them omega-3 fatty acids, and an increase in the irisin. By the way, irisin is what is called a mycokine, and it's released from the muscles during physical activity that helps transform white fat into brown fat that continues to burn energy after exercise. And because of its ability to increase energy expenditure, irisin has gained interest as a treatment for type 2 diabetes and related disorders. So do your omega-3s, 1,000 milligrams in the morning, 1,000 milligrams in the evening. And that is the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Just want to remind those of you who are interested that this Sunday evening at 5 to 7 p.m., it probably will go longer, I'll be doing a special webinar on what to do when crisis strikes, any crisis. It could be a hurricane, earthquake, fires, a solar burst. It could be rising the sea level. It could be drought. But most people are not prepared. In fact, almost no one's prepared. And we have to ask why. Why is it that, for example, in Louisiana, in one parish, a parish is equivalent to a county, there were 63,000 damaged homes by water. This is just in the last 6 months. And the whole state was devastated. No one was prepared because it hadn't happened. But we had seven once-in-500-year events within the last year. None of those people were prepared. So it's time that we realize that the Earth is changing, climate changes cause feedback loops and tipping points. The Arctic has had the lowest ice, winter ice, in its history of being recorded. So we're getting to that Guy McPherson countdown date that he talked about on this program, and others have spoken about as well, when we're ice-free. And once we're ice-free, then the methane starts percolating up, not just in the Arctic, but clear across the whole Arctic Circle, Norway, and through the frozen permafrost of Russia. And then you're going to see a jump up so fast in temperature that it'll catch everyone by surprise. And then all these feedback loops happen. And then where we had rain, we won't. Where we didn't have rain, we'll have too much, where drought will become extreme, and we'll have water wars. So things are going to get rough. I just wish people would be aware of it. Because we're protected, because we live in our own isolated environments, we think it's not happening, it won't happen. It's going to happen. So why not prepare for it, where you have time and resources and work together towards what you want? Recently on a plane, a person came over and said, I hear your radio show occasionally, not all the time, but I heard you mentioning on a show about these sustainable communities. Is that the same as an intentional community? And the answer is no. Almost everyone is trying to get into an intentional community. Big mistake. They never work. They're all failures. You can say Finhorn, and I can show you what's wrong with Finhorn. But I'm going to explain the difference between intentional communities and sustainable communities and homesteads. You're going to start by watching Saving the Planet, and then, and by the way, I have a whole list of information anticipating what you're going to know. What states, what cities, how do you buy this? Where do you go for that? I've put all these lists of articles, books, everything that I'm going to be giving to the people who are in the webinar. So it'll help you. Anyhow, if you want to join me, and it should be fun, I'm going to give you a number that you can call and you can sign up. And it'll be this coming Sunday. And I'll give you that number in just a little, let's see. No, I can give it to you now. 646-926-5435. 646-926-5435. All right. No, I've got another number. I'm sorry. Someone just gave me another number. 646-926-5423. Here's the other number, 646-926-5423 for the webinar. In about 10 minutes from now, we'll go to our guest. This is something I think is important for us to understand. We have a government, in my opinion, that many of its agencies, not all, many of its employees, not all, but certainly the military-industrial complex, the spy complex, the medical-industrial complex, the financial complex, including all of its exotic derivatives and all of its Wall Street proponents, including the food-industrial mono-food complex that promotes industrial farming and GMOs and pesticides. These people have undue influence over our reality. They are the kleptocrats. And by the way, John Whitehead is starting a new program on the Progressive Radio Network. We're also reaching out to Dick Gregory, who's a friend for a long time, and some other, the Government Accountability Project. We have all kinds of brand new programs that meet our needs. But anyhow, the American government, according to some, is under the control of these autocrats, these very powerful, wealthy people. And they continue to, in effect, take the American public down the rabbit hole into the parallel universe in which the Constitution is meaningless. The government is all-powerful. The citizens have no power to defend itself against government agents who steal, spy, lie, plunder, kill, abuse, and generally inflict mayhem and sow madness on everyone and everything in their path. Case in point. This is from John Whitehead. Quote, in the same week that WikiLeaks dropped its bombshell about the CIA's use of spy tools to subject law-abiding Americans to all manner of government surveillance and hacking, a revelation that caused barely a ripple of concern among the citizenry, the government quietly and with little fanfare continued to wage its devastating, stomach-churning, debilitating war on the American people. Incredibly, hardly anybody noticed. This begs the question, if the government is overstepping its authority, abusing its power, and disregarding the rule of law, but no one seems to notice and no one seems to care, does it matter if the government has become a tyrant? End quote. So that's my question. I'm going to take a few calls if we have people who would like to share their thoughts on this, and I know this audience does. You want your freedom of choice. You want to be informed not based upon what the government tells you is right, but what your own ability to do critical research and thinking determines is right. So give us a call now on our talkback number, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Just consider just one week, in March, police were given the go-ahead to keep stealing from Americans who were innocent of any wrongdoing. In refusing to hear a challenge to Texas asset forfeiture law, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed Texas police to keep hundreds of thousands of dollars in ill-gotten cash, primarily on the basis that the seized cash from innocent Texans was being transported on a highway that drug dealers had used, despite any proof of illegal activity by the people who were stopped and confiscated their assets. Now think of that. The Supreme Court said it's okay for the police to stop you, to take everything you own, to take all the money out of your bank account. They could even take your home if they wanted. They do not have to even give you a ticket. And that's because at some point in time, some drug person used that highway that you were driving on, and therefore that makes it legal. Wow. That's how far down the rabbit hole of reason and logic and justice we have gone. Asset forfeiture laws that I've spoken about many times on this program, which have come under intense scrutiny and criticism in recent years, allow the police to seize property suspected of being connected to criminal activity, but not having to prove that the owner of the property is guilty of any criminal offense. So that's how it works. And by the way, it was on April 1st, James Lenard was driving with a companion on U.S. Highway 59, Texas, when the vehicle was stopped by a state police officer for allegedly speeding and following another vehicle too closely. A subsequent search of the vehicle disclosed a safe in the trunk, which had belonged to Leonard's mother, Lisa, and it contained some cash. And when the police contacted Lisa, the mother, she confirmed that the safe's contents belonged to her, that the contents constituted personal business, and that she would not consent to allowing the officer to open the safe. So they got a search warrant. The safe was open. They found $201,000, and that was from a sale of her home in Pennsylvania. Well, what they did is they kept it and said that they believed it was from possession of illegal drugs. Mind you, they got a bill of sale. It's right there. This money came from the sale of her home. Didn't matter. We believe it's from drugs. They kept it. The Supreme Court upheld that. So that just gives you an idea of the kind of country right now and the kind of laws we're faced with. And I can read you citation after citation after citation of how the police have been given more leeway and how much damage they can inflict on those they serve and to the extent to which they can disregard the Constitution. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of a police officer who allowed a police dog to maul a homeless man who had done nothing. He was innocent of any wrongdoing. The case arose after a police dog attacked a homeless man under an abandoned house where police were tracking a robbery suspect. The cop refused to call off the dog immediately despite the man's pleading and the fact that he did not match the description of the robbery suspect. The homeless man suffered deep bites and on his thighs, his hands, that required 16-inch skin graft as well as severe, he suffered severe bleeding, bruising, swelling, and arterial blood clot. Incredibly, not only did the court declare that the police officer was protected by qualified immunity, which incentivizes government officials to violate constitutional rights without fear of repercussion, but it had the nerve to suggest that being mauled by a police dog is the equivalent of a lawful Terry stop in which police may stop and hold a person for questioning on the basis of reasonable suspicion. So, and also on March 9th, government officials assured a Michigan Supreme Court that there was nothing unlawful, unreasonable, or threatening about the prospect of armed police dressed in SWAT gear knocking on doors at 4 a.m. and asking the owners to engage in warrantless knock-and-talk sessions. Although the government lawyers insisted citizens can choose to say no to such heavy-handed requests by police to conduct unwarranted interrogations. And so they get away with it, and there's a lot more. So if you don't think your rights are being taken away from you, if you think because it has not happened to you that it's not going to ever happen, then you haven't been a person profiled. You haven't been a person who's been stopped and searched. You haven't been a person who has had asset forfeiture, that you've committed no crime. There's only one law in the United States that we must use as our final arbiter of all that is legal, and that is the Constitution. And it is just shameful, in my personal opinion, of how various agents within our government have decided that the Constitution does not apply to them. That's how it works. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. If we have any calls on this, we'll take them. Otherwise, we'll go to my guests. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome our guest now from New York City, and who is here to talk about something that rarely gets mentioned. In fact, I haven't heard any programs on this topic before, so I'm looking forward to this. And I also want to take a look at what happens when we have people in positions of power whose authority to make decisions and have various governmental agencies carry out those decisions could be impacting people in a negative way. So we're going to do that in just a moment, but I'm having a little technical issue. I'm going to take just a second, and now there we have it fixed. I'm not in the city, I'm not in my studio, but I have audio now. So let's say hello to Professor James Gilligan. I gave you a little of his background earlier. He is professor of clinical psychiatry at New York University Medical School and adjunct professor at New York University's Law School. And for 30 years, he has researched and investigated violent behavior. And his expertise on violence has been called upon by various administrations, the World Court, Kofi Annan's UN project to tackle violence against children, and many other institutions. In the past, he was on the faculty of Harvard's Medical School and the director of the Bridgewater State Hospital and director of medical health for Massachusetts prison system. And he is also an author. And when he was heading up one of the important prison and violence projects, during his tenure there, the prison system, the prison suicide and homicide rates declined to near zero. And he is also the author of several books, including Why Some Politicians Are More Dangerous Than Others. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I want to first give the audience a brief gist of your recent observations and research before we dive into the subject matter. And in the course of your research into violence and its trends and causes for almost 30 years, you noted that national homicide and suicide rates, starting around 1900, when records were first being kept, showed statistically significant highs and lows. And on a chart, it might look like a series of mountain ranges. But what's most surprising is that for the past 100-plus years, the highs corresponded to Republican administrations, whereas decreases and lows were during periods when the Democrats occupied the White House. The question, therefore, is whether or not there is any correlation between murder and suicide rates in the political parties or presidents in office at the time and their policies. So having said that, give us a bit of a historical overview of this observation through the American presidential administrations, and what are some of the most salient features of both parties that contributed to the rise and fall of homicides and suicide rates? The forum is yours.
Yes. When I first discovered this, and I should add that these are the government's own data, not mine. I'm simply a was looking at the vital statistics branch of the U.S. Public Health Service, which documents how many people die each year and what they die from, based on the death certificates that physicians make out for when people die. So they're the most accurate statistics we have about violence in America. What amazed me was when I couldn't understand why these rates of both homicide and suicide, the two forms of lethal violence, increased and decreased. And incidentally, they increase and decrease together. That is, when the homicide rate goes up, so does the suicide rate. When the homicide rate goes down, so does the suicide rate. So they parallel each other. But I couldn't understand why they sometimes rose up, if you put them on a chart, like to the peak of a mountain, and then they drop dramatically down to the valley, and then they go back to a peak. And I finally noticed that corresponded to the presidential election cycle. They reached the peaks when and only when a Republican administration was in power, and it was after that administration got elected to power, and the peaks dropped down to the valleys when and only when a Democratic administration came into power. Now, I thought at first that it can't be this simple. This is absurd. Politics is much too complicated to have such a simple pattern. On the other hand, I did everything I could to disprove that, and I couldn't. These correlations have withstood every statistical test I could give to them. So I thought, well, what could be the causal mechanisms explaining these correlations between the political party and the violent death rates? I discovered three things. They're closely related to each other, which actually gives them strength. That means that they're more likely to be true. The first is both the rate of unemployment and the duration of unemployment. When unemployment increases, so does the rates of homicide and suicide. When the unemployment rate and the duration of unemployment goes down, rates of suicide and homicide go down. Now, as it turns out, I also discovered that both the rate and the duration of unemployment have increased during every single Republican administration throughout the period for which we have data on this, which goes back to 1900. So we have more than a century of data. Every Republican administration has been followed, once it came into power, by an increase in the unemployment rate. And every single Democratic administration, without a single exception, has been followed by a decrease in the unemployment rate, as well as you find that as a decrease in rates of violence. So that was one factor. A second is recessions and depressions. How frequently do recessions or depressions occur? How deep are they, and how long do they last? On all those characteristics, the Republican administrations have a much worse record than the Democratic administrations. Recessions and depressions have been more serious. Well, think about it. The Great Depression occurred during the administration of the Republicans during the Roaring Twenties. And the most severe recession since the Great Depression occurred toward the end of George W. Bush's administration. The recovery from those occurred under Democratic administrations, the earlier one under Roosevelt and second one under Obama, which, by the way, would have occurred much more successfully if Obama himself hadn't been so frustrated by a Republican majority in the Houses of Congress. A third factor is the size of the gap between the rich and the poor. Now, there's inequalities of income and of wealth. All of those have increased under Republican administrations and decreased under Democratic ones to a statistically significant degree. So we have, you know, socioeconomic variables that can explain the correlation between the political party and the lethal violence rate in America. So what occurred to me was, you know, I'm a physician. I'm taught to pay attention to evidence-based medicine. You know, we base our treatments on evidence. I think it's time we also had evidence-based politics and make our political choices based on evidence. Which party is causing greater or lesser degrees of socioeconomic stress and failure and increased or decreased rates of lethal violence? It's very clear. The party on the more liberal left-wing part of the political spectrum is clearly much more compatible with life and prosperity.
Okay, I'd like to offer a few suggestions, and if you would address these, I would appreciate it. You have created a formula, and I would look at the Clinton administration on three levels to offer a different perspective. The greatest incarceration rate in American history, in world history, occurred under Bill Clinton. The greatest deprivation in our social welfare system occurred under Bill Clinton, where over 1.5 million African Americans, Latinos, and poor whites lost their welfare benefits, and also the greatest increase in income inequality, where the combination of Bill Clinton, his Treasury Secretary, Lawrence Summers, and members of the GOP worked together to destroy the Glass-Steagall Act, which allowed then the banking system that had not been able to engage in casino capitalism to do so, which created massive, massive wealth disparities. And also from 1972 on, you had over 58,000 major corporations and factories that were purchased and downsized or exchanged the workers, American workers, for foreign workers because it was cheaper. These also must be considered instead of just whether it's a Democrat or Republican in the White House. Your thoughts, please.
Okay, yeah, sure. Let me take those one by one. First of all, the imprisonment rate. Actually, that the increase in the imprisonment rate did not start under Bill Clinton. It started long before that, when the Republicans finally got back into power in a major way in 1968, when Nixon got elected. And, you know, we'd had really a Democratic leadership virtually without any interruptions since Roosevelt got elected in 1932. By 1968, the Republicans finally roared back into power with Nixon, and Nixon declared a war on crime and a war on drugs, which were both code messages for a war on blacks and the poor. And what happened was, for the first time in our history, the imprisonment rate started going up. Throughout the first three quarters of the 20th century, our imprisonment rate was virtually flat. We had roughly 100 people per 100,000 population in our prisons and jails for the first 75 years of the 20th century. Then when Nixon was in power for the first time after he declared war on crime, we started having, for the first time, a huge unprecedented increase in the imprisonment rate, which occurred for the next a quarter of a century. The Republicans were in power 20 of those 24 years, and the imprisonment rate increased roughly sixfold, from 100 to more than six, actually up to about sevenfold, from roughly 100 per 100,000 to 700 per 100,000. So we were imprisoning seven times more people per capita than we had throughout the first three quarters of the century. This did continue during the 4 years of Jimmy Carter, and it did continue under the 8 years of Clinton, although the rate of increase was actually lower under Clinton than it had been under his Republican predecessors. It still did go up. That's true. On the other hand, it was only after Clinton got elected that rates of both homicide and suicide started the most dramatic decrease that they had since the 1930s. And that every single year of the Clinton administration, there was a decrease in suicide and homicide. Now, how about welfare and the economy? Yes, he did drop some of the welfare arrangements that we had, and that, I think, it was an unfortunate development, which, of course, would not have happened if there hadn't been so much opposition from the Republicans. Clinton was trying to stay in power and get into power by appealing to the right wing. However, Clinton did do some other things that he's often not given credit for. For example, the most effective anti-poverty program that we've ever had in this country, and I think there's agreement on this from both Democrats and Republicans, that is the negative income tax, the earned income tax, which gives money to people whose incomes are low enough instead of taking money from them. Now, the Republicans, when Clinton was in power, wanted to eliminate the earned income tax credit. However, Clinton succeeded in getting the earned income tax credit increased by the greatest degree since it first became part of our tax system. What was the result of that? One result was that the proportion of African-American and Latino families that were living below the poverty line got to the lowest level since those figures first started being recorded during the Clinton administration. In other words, he reduced poverty among blacks and Latinos more than had been shown since we first started measuring that. Now, what I would say is I'm not at all saying that the Democrats are the ideal party. Even the Democrats in this country are conservative compared to the social democratic parties of Western Europe, or compared to parties in the other English-speaking democracies like Canada or Australia, New Zealand. I'm not saying the Democrats are perfect. I'm simply saying that relative to the Republicans, they are dramatically better on several counts. There are some areas where they're not better, but they are dramatically better than the Republicans with respect to the variables, you know, that I've been studying. I wish we had a more liberal left-wing Democratic Party. I'm certainly much more aligned with Bernie Sanders than with the standard Democrats.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. And if the Democrats in power would have been honest at the Democratic National Committee, there's a high probability that Bernie Sanders would have been the nominee against Trump and would have handily beat Trump, and we'd be a lot better off today.
I think a lot of people would agree with that.
My concern is, being an activist, a social and political activist, environmental activist for all my entire life, I saw the Clintons not as Democrats. They didn't see themselves as Democrats, and hence they did not represent the true liberal historical FDR establishment. They were the new Democrats. And if you remember, Al Gore and Bill Clinton prided themselves in being the new Democrats. They saw that their political power came when they joined with Newt Gingrich to create that center-right approach. And that's where a lot of his policies came. When you look at war and you look at the Democrats getting us into the Republicans getting us into Iraq and Afghanistan, neither of which we should have been in because neither was the cause of 9/11. And look at the devastation that had the blowback and the after effects of that.
Sure.
But then you take a look at Hillary Clinton. She's the one who was the primary architect of the war in Libya and the invasion of Syria. We now know from WikiLeaks that the documents show why we got into Libya, and it was not what we were told, and also in Syria, and again the lies, and also the destabilization of other economies and presidencies. I have a list that I've accumulated of 68 countries that the United States, from the end of World War II till now, we have engaged in unethical, illegal activities to change any of the regimes that we did not like who they were. And it really didn't matter whether they were Republican or Democrat. They both engaged in this. And when you look at President Obama, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, and Obama keeps hailing this unemployment rate, something that you also mentioned, well, I said this couldn't be true because we have exactly 102.5 million unemployed Americans who were once employed. How can you say that we have 4.8% unemployment when you have 102 million unemployed people? And then you start seeing that it's the game of their myth of how they calculate the figures. The actual unemployment rate in the United States is closer to 22 to 23% by any legitimate standard. And then you start looking at the wars that we now have, the regime changes in other countries under the Democrats. And if they were true liberals, and that's where I think that we should draw a line here. Are you representing true liberal philosophy, or are you representing corporate democratic philosophy and the hegemony and the overreach as a neoliberalist and a globalist that comes with that? And then I don't think it matters who's in office, except it did with FDR, that since that time, with the exception of Eisenhower, we have had mostly, since Reagan, we've had mostly this overreach of regime change. So I can't see where one or the other is going to make it a more peaceful world and cause less violence to the world, even if it causes less violence for Americans. Your thoughts, please.
Well, yes. I mean, you have raised a different topic from what I was talking about earlier. As you just said, I was focusing on our domestic violence rate, interpersonal and individual homicides and suicides, not collective political military violence. There, I think both parties have stumbled badly at various different times. It is true that Clinton, in fact, did keep us out of wars. I mean, there were no wars during his time. And as you said, Eisenhower was actually probably the most liberal Republican of the 20th century, and he refused to go into a lot of wars, although he did there even under Eisenhower. The U.S.'s history of
Iran, 1953,
is terrible. I mean, the U.S., you're absolutely right. There's no question. The U.S. has been a major source of violence, and I think what can only be called imperialism, in effect. And I think both parties can be criticized on that. With respect to Obama, I mean, again, it's complicated. I'm not going to say Obama didn't make major mistakes. On the other hand, he inherited this horrendous mess from George W. Bush. And I think one thing that shows is it is much easier to cause a problem than it is to solve it. I mean, George W. Bush left Obama with a can of worms, and Obama did not solve it. It's just much easier to create chaos than to create order, and that's what George W. Bush did.
There's something new. One second. There's something new that I'd like you to address, if you would, please.
Sure.
One of the newest studies shows that middle-age individuals, and it doesn't matter what their ethnicity, are committing suicide and dying at a faster level than we have seen in a long period of time. And then when you look at why, and they did an analysis, this was Yale University.
Yes.
They found that it was a loss of hope in the future, the loss of things they had worked for up to this point in their life, frequently the divorces and the dissolution of a marriage and family, the fact that they could not count upon things from the past of supporting them in the future. There was too much that was out of their control, and simply feeling, what am I supposed to do? There's also those individuals who are committing suicide who are in the lower economic income, and those are people from Appalachia, from Louisiana, from mainly the southern states, but there are a few northern states like Wisconsin and in Michigan where they don't believe that either party in power will honor their pledge and get industry going again. So the result is younger people using hillbilly heroin, OxyContin, and the older is using alcohol, but they have no life, and therefore they're stuck in this sense of absolute apathy. Your thoughts.
First of all, I think everything you said is correct. Just one technical thing. Even under Obama, although the homicide rate, the murder rate, has gotten to the lowest level in the last 50 years, which is the opposite of what Donald Trump and Jeffrey Sessions have been saying. They've just been telling out-and-out lies, saying that the country is in the midst of a violent crime wave. We have not had murder rates this low for the last 50 years. However, the suicide rate has increased. But if you add the suicide rate and the homicide rate together, the total lethal violence rate, it still is the lowest in at least the last 30 years. It's lower than it was during this period of Republican hegemony that started under Richard Nixon.
Thank you for being on. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Professor James Gilligan, and he is the author of a very important work, Why Some Politicians Are More Dangerous Than Others. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.